Isaiah 11:1 through 12:6, the 13th talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on June 6, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We'll be looking at Isaiah chapter 11. And maybe even 12 today. In chapter 11, we get a glimpse into the future, a glimpse at the time to come, the new kingdom. And we see again a figure that was introduced earlier in Isaiah appearing again. We first saw this figure in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. I'll read that to you again. It says, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and from forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this." So there's going to be this Prince of Peace that is to come, and he will sit on the throne of David, and his reign will be characterized by peace and righteousness and justice, and it will be eternal. In chapter 11, we see him again. Let me read the first five verses. "Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist." So here is this same figure that we saw back two chapters in Isaiah. And here we get a little more information in a little bit different context. Again, it points out that he is a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. Jesse being the father of David. So this is from the line of David, apparently, that this ruler will come. In chapter 9, it had said that he would sit upon the throne of David. Now we're saying that it is from the line of David again. Just as a point of interest, remember, this is being written by Isaiah at a time in which the kingdom of Judah in the south and the kingdom of Israel in the north still exist. But if you will recall, when the two kingdoms split, the northern kingdom went with a king who was not a descendant of David. So none of the kings of the northern kingdom were descendants of David. In the southern kingdom, however, all of the kings are in the line of David all the way through. So it's only in the southern kingdom that they are looking at people in the same dynasty that was established by David. And yet, in the southern kingdom, the kings were fair to poor. None of them matched the quality of person and quality of rule that we had in David. So this is a prophecy that's being made about a descendant of David, but as they're looking out at their experience, none of the kings in this line have matched up to David to that point. But this one that is coming is going to be uniquely blessed by God. He will have a special relationship with God in that the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. And that Spirit will manifest itself in a number of qualities or abilities that this king will have. Those being wisdom, understanding, counsel and strength, the spirit of knowledge, and the fear of the Lord. I think that if we reflect upon the rulers of our day, these are qualities that any of us would find attractive in a ruler. If a ruler had these qualities and ruled accordingly, it would be a glorious thing. It would be truly a glorious thing. If you will recall back to the time when the kingship was first established in Israel, remember that the people of Israel appealed to Samuel and said, "Give us a king. We need a king." And Samuel said, "No, that would be a big mistake." And the people said, "Oh, give us a king. We've got to have a king." And Samuel referred the matter to God, and God said it would be a bad thing. And then he instructed Samuel as to what he was supposed to do in order to anoint a king. And when he went out to anoint a king, he picked someone that looked like he would be a good ruler. He was tall and handsome and strong. He looked like the kind of person that they would want for a king. And he was anointed and became the king, and that was Saul. Saul turned out to be a poor ruler and went crazy. Then, was it Samuel that anointed David? I think so. Samuel then anointed a replacement for Saul, David. And David was, when he went out to anoint him, he was sent to Jesse's family. And when he went to select the one that he was supposed to anoint, all of the promising candidates, the sons of Jesse, were put before Samuel. And he looked at all of them, and none of those were right. It was the unlikely one. It was David that was anointed. So in the selection of even the dynasty of David, it was the unlikely one, the one that didn't look like he was ruler material, that panned out. The one that looked like ruler material did not pan out. So what looked to us like the qualities that we would want in a ruler are not the qualities that make a good ruler, but rather it's those qualities that God values. And here we have that list of values that the righteous ruler will have. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. So this ruler will be his heart's desire to have respect for and value what God values. And therefore, when it comes to justice, he will establish perfect justice. He will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make decisions by what his ears hear. So he is not going to establish justice on the basis of partiality, on the basis of what he hears and sees, but rather on the standard of what is right in God's eyes. And that will manifest itself by an equity of justice. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. We've talked about this before, but I want to talk about it again. There are a number of times in the Old Testament where this becomes the standard of the health of a society, that you look at the poor and the powerless and see how they are treated. If they are treated well, you're looking at a healthy society. If they are oppressed, if they are taken advantage of, then you are looking at an unhealthy society. It doesn't necessarily only happen with judges. It's not just dependent upon judges. In any society, lots of people wield power. This fact was impressed upon me when I was studying in the Soviet Union. When you go into a museum in Russia, it is standard procedure that you check your coat in. They have cold winters, and oftentimes the coats are big and bulky, and it's warm inside, you don't need it. So there's this custom, there's a coat check area at every public building. So the first thing you do when you go in is you check your coat. So you give your coat to the coat check lady. It's always a lady. And she will give you a little number on a round, usually stamped in metal or on a piece of wood. And then you go see the museum, and then when you come out, you give this little chit back to her, and she returns your coat. Well, those coat check ladies are power brokers. You wouldn't think so, but they are. Because when you come back, it's up to her to decide who she's going to serve next. And it is rather standard procedure that if you're a foreigner, you give her a piece of gum so that you get your coat back right away. Otherwise, you will stand there and stand there and stand there. She may wait on half a dozen or a dozen people before she waits on you, unless you give the piece of gum. Well, that really struck me, because you don't think of a coat check person as being a powerful position. And yet there is a certain amount of power there. So the question is, how's that person going to use that power? Is that person going to use that power to their own personal advantage, or are they going to use that power equitably and justly? So it's not just judges that are in a position to take advantage of the powerless. Power is distributed throughout a society. There are lots of people who are power brokers, in a sense. And so the question is, as a whole, how are we going to relate to the powerless? And what happens when we have power is we have the natural tendency as sinful human beings to use that power to our advantage, to better ourselves, and to protect ourselves from the powerful. So it's out of trying to gain or fear of punishment that we act partially to those who have power, to the detriment of those who don't have power. So there's a sense in which those who don't have power are victimized in an unhealthy society, will be victimized at every turn. The only thing that mitigates that is a moral health, a moral and spiritual health in society that sees justice as a value in and of itself. And here, this righteous ruler that will come along, he does not judge on what his eyes see or what his ears hear. He doesn't change his judgment on the basis of who it is that he's dealing with. That his administration of justice is based on the standard of justice and a love of justice, which he gets from delighting in the fear of the Lord. That his respect is first and foremost for God and not for the powerful. So, we can, as I mentioned before, we can tell the health of a society by looking at how a society deals with the powerless, the poor. Now, I want to throw in a little digression here. Just because a society has a program for poverty does not mean that it cares about the poor. There is a wonderful quote by Hannah Arendt it's in On Revolutions, a book that she wrote about the great revolutions that have happened in Western civilization. And she makes the comment with respect to the French Revolution. She says, before the French Revolution, there was no poverty, only poor people. That's a very important observation on her part. And that is that we as human beings, we sense that we need to be fair and just. And that means treating the poor fair and justly. But on the other hand, we are self-serving. And as a result, we want to have it both ways. We want to be self-serving and feel good about ourselves in the way that we treat the poor. So we have developed this way of abstracting things out so that we can fight poverty but be indifferent to the poor. There is a wonderful scene in Cancer Ward by Solzhenitsyn. Cancer Ward is a wonderful novel. You should read it if you have not. In this cancer ward in the Soviet Union, it brings together people from every segment of society within the Soviet Union. They're all thrown into one room in this hospital and have to deal with each other. And one of the people that's in this room was a high party official, so a very privileged position within Soviet society. And according to communist doctrine, the thing that is of paramount importance is the people, the masses. Because communism is supposed to be the ultimate in democracy. And so the people fare best, the people as a whole, the masses, they fare best under communism, according to theory. And so this guy, this party official, as he's interacting with the other cancer patients in this room, he is constantly talking about how he serves the people, and the people are of paramount importance to him and to Soviet society and all that sort of thing. And at one point, the narrator says, he loved the masses. He just couldn't stand people. There's a disconnect there. He loves the abstraction, but it's just people he couldn't get along with and didn't care about. And when it talks about justice for the poor, it's talking about justice for poor people. It's talking about a concern for individuals who are powerless in society, not interest in these abstractions that simply soothe our conscience so that we can think that we are righteous while we are actually indifferent to the people who are powerless. I mention this because there are some things happening in society. I'm sensing some undercurrents that to me seem to indicate that there is a growing interest in people becoming more humane. We're carrying out humane wars. We're doing all kinds of humane things. We're having the most moral government in history. The rhetoric is being elevated to emphasizing goodness and humaneness. But my concern is that what's being elevated is these abstractions rather than true compassion and charity. And they are not the same thing. Hannah Arendt was right. There was no poverty before the French Revolution. There were just poor people. There's a difference between the two. And we need to keep that in mind. Okay, furthermore, having finished my digression, furthermore, then this righteous ruler, He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. He is going to bring righteousness. He is going to destroy evil and wickedness with the mere speech of his lips. There will be no challenge. It will be easily dealt with. They will be destroyed. And indeed, everything that he does will be characterized by righteousness and faithfulness. Faithfulness in the sense of faithful to his promises. Faithful to what's true and what's valuable. That righteousness will be the belt about his loins and faithfulness the belt about his waist. So that's a snapshot then of the kind of rule that will be established by this descendant of Jesse. Not only will his rule of society be transformed, that it will be a righteous society that will be established under his rule, but creation itself will be changed. Verse 6, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze. Their young will lie down together. And the lion will eat straw like the ox. And the nursling child will play by the hole of the cobra. And the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. In all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Interesting picture in which, in our experience, these animals are vicious. They are killers. If you put a wolf with a lamb, the wolf will eat the lamb, etc., etc. Contrary to our Disney-esque picture of nature, which is we have recently generated, in which the wolfies only eat the lammies if the lammies are sicky. We moved out in the country. Well, we're what, 100 yards in the country? We're across the street from the city, but we have some acreage, and it's amazing how different it is from being in the city. Just because I notice different things, we have a larger collection of animals instead of the standard possums. We have in addition to the standard possums, we have fox and we have raccoons and an occasional deer and. Pheasant and all kinds of stuff. One of the things that we inherited some cats. We have never owned a cat, but we inherited them and continue to inherit them from time to time. But when we first moved in, we had several cats that came with the house, no extra charge. And I had never watched cats catch mice before. Have you ever watched a cat catch a mouse? I guess it's not the catching that's so bad, it's after they catch it. They play with the cat, with the mouse. They'll throw it up in the air, and then they'll go and pounce on it, and they'll let it run away about 3 yards, and they'll go pounce on it, and throw it here, and throw it there, throw it to their kitten, and it's amazing, and it's incredibly cruel. I mean, you can't look at it and not sympathize with the mouse. You want to go and free the mouse. I mean, it is incredibly cruel. But it's natural. I've also watched chickens. We don't have this problem. Our chickens are nice chickens. I think they've just got a big enough yard that they can stay apart. But I lived with my older brother for a year, and he had a lot of chickens in a small area. And they have, the term pecking order came from somewhere. And that is, the chickens establish their hierarchy. And they do it by the biggest bully wins is the way it works. And they do it by pecking at each other. But one time, the one lowest on the pecking order one day I was watching them, and all the others, whenever it would walk by, they'd just turn and peck it on the back. And they drew blood. And once there was blood, then they all went after this chicken. And they killed it that day. And I didn't realize it, but that had happened before. Apparently that's standard procedure. Nature is cruel. There's a cruelty built into nature. It's true that nature is incredibly intricate and sophisticated and orderly. There's something really fascinating about how everything works together. Something really marvelous. But there is also something perverse in nature. That there's something, there's cruelty in it. I mean, animals kill animals, and they kill the animals in a way that's not nice. And here in the new heavens and the new earth, apparently, that will be changed. That we're going to have lions and bears. Let's see, lions and tigers and bears. We have the bear grazing and we have the lion grazing rather than feasting on other animals. So a change in creation, a change in the created order that apparently will take place that will remove this cruelty, this thing that's kind of perverse that's within nature. I suspect, I don't know this for sure, but I suspect that this is related to what it talks about in Romans 8, where it says that creation was subjected to futility, that this is a part of that. And it was subjected to futility for us, for our benefit. And that it continues to groan until our adoption as sons. And I suspect then that this is part of what's going to be the case in the new heavens and the new earth, that creation will be removed from its subjection to futility. And therefore it will be a different kind of place, a place in which that perversity is removed, and all that remains will be that marvelous intricacy and sophistication that we see there. And it will be removed because the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord. An interesting explanation for why this will be the case, because the animals are not acting out of rationality as we think of it. They're acting out of instinct. But knowledge of the Lord must be a broader concept. That is, things will operate according to God's principles of right and wrong. Things will operate the way He wants them to operate. So the animal's intuition itself will be transformed such that it is in accord with the way that He wants it to be. But it says that the knowledge of the Lord, the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It's a wonderful image. It will be absolutely everywhere, the knowledge of the Lord. Just as a comment, this same phrase, the knowledge of the Lord, is one of the things that will characterize this ruler, as it points out in, in verse 2, the last couplet, the spirit of the knowledge and the fear of the Lord will be things that will characterize this ruler. Verse 10, then it will come about in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. So this descendant of Jesse again will he will stand as a signal. We've seen that before. It's a rallying point, the thing to which everyone will look and come. And his resting place will be glorious. Resting place. It's reminiscent of the story of creation in which on the seventh day God rested. So that becomes the permanent state, the state after the work is done. And this descendant of Jesse then will find his resting place, come to his permanent position, and it will be glorious. Verses 11 through 16. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. He will lift up a standard for the nations and will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. And they will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. Together they will plunder the sons of the east. They will possess Edom and Moab, and the sons of Ammon will be subject to them. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the Sea of Egypt, and he will wave his hand over the river with his scorching wind, and he will strike it into seven streams and make men walk over dry shod. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will be left, just as there was for Israel in the day that they came out of the land of Egypt. So in addition to this righteous reign being established, the people, the descendants of Abraham, will be recollected. They will be brought back to Israel. They will come, they will respond to the standard that will be raised by the righteous ruler. And they will come from all over the world. Notice that it says that the Lord will recover the second time with his hand. The first time apparently being when they returned from their exile. And this is talking about a second time when they will be coming from all over the world, returning to Israel. They'll be responding to his standard that he sets up. He will stand up the standard which everyone will know as this thing that calls them. We've seen this image before. God set up his standard for the Assyrians to mount their attack and come to Israel. So they come to the standard. But now it's a different kind of coming to the standard. Now it's the people of Israel that are returning to Israel in response to him having lifted the standard. And not only will they all return from all four corners of the earth to Israel, but now this bitter division that has occurred within the people of Israel, between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, that bitterness will be removed. It will be a united people this time. The jealousy will be gone, and they will not be harassing one another. Having been unified then, they will go out against their enemies, the Philistines to the west, and to the east, Edom and Moab and the Ammonites. So they are going to destroy all of their historical enemies, the ones that have preyed on them historically. Furthermore, not just the near neighbors, but those nations which historically had subjected the people of Israel to slavery, they will be crushed and release from the slavery in those areas will be made possible. Now, I don't know whether this is figurative language or whether this is these are things that will literally take place, but the tongue of the Sea of Egypt apparently refers to the Red Sea. Well, the Red Sea was the obstacle that stood between the people of Israel and their freedom back in the time of the Exodus. And in order to overcome that obstacle, God had Moses stretch out his staff and the sea parted. Well, a similar thing is going to happen again. God is going to act in an overt manner again. And he will destroy the tongue of the Sea of Egypt. So again, that obstacle will be removed and the people will be able to return from their slavery. That's towards the direction of Egypt, towards the direction it says he will wave his hand over the river. The river typically refers to the Euphrates and Asher, the place of the Assyrians, was located on the Euphrates. And they are the ones that Isaiah is talking about. As Isaiah is speaking, they are the ones that are on the doorstep of Israel and later will come into Judah. And out of Israel, they will take a number of people into exile. That river, he will wave his hand over it and it will split up into seven streams. And man will be able to walk over it dry shod. So again, the obstacle that stands in the way of the people of Israel being released from their enslavement will be made possible by God's overt action. Verse 16, and there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will be left. So God is going to break down all of these barriers, make it possible for people who even have been subjected to slavery to be released from that human bondage and come back to Israel, respond to the banner, the standard that's been raised. Okay. Then chapter 12. Having said all of this then, Isaiah says, and your response in that day will be to break out in a song of thanksgiving for what God has done. And here's the song that they will sing. Then you will say on that day, I will give thanks to thee, O Lord, for although thou wast angry at me, thine anger is turned away, and thou dost comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. Therefore you will joyously draw water from the springs of salvation. And in that day you will say, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known his deeds among the peoples, make them remember that his name is exalted. Praise the Lord in song, for he has done excellent things. Let this be known throughout the earth. Cry aloud and shout for joy, O inhabitant of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. So in the end, they will recognize that what has happened has been the severe mercy of God. What they've experienced has been an act of God in which there was suffering. Suffering was an integral part of this. But through that suffering, God was able to teach them who he is, both his mercy and his loyalty to his promises. And so the people will at that time rejoice in what God has done, be thankful for the salvation that he has provided, and recognize that salvation. And furthermore, then, proclaim that to the rest of the world. They will become bearers of this gospel to the whole earth. It's an amazing story. All of history is an amazing story, and that's basically what he's talking about here, the end of history. God is in the process of teaching all of us, in a sense, who he is, what are his attributes. And it's been kind of a long, strange, crazy trip. But God knows what he's doing, and he will, in fact, impress upon us the lessons that he wants us to learn. Now, as I reflect on what what we've seen so far in Isaiah, and as I've thought about this and studying, I've come to see Isaiah as, it's kind of like an impressionistic painting. Because we keep seeing the same themes coming back. For instance, here we have this descendant of Jesse. And in chapter 9, we had a little bit about the Prince of Peace. And it seems to be the same person. But we get different information in each section. So these same themes keep coming up, but they're all jumbled up in this mess. It's not a coherent and chronological exposition of what history is going to look like. But it does create, like an impressionist painting, if you stand back, there are certain features that begin to emerge. It may not have emerged the way that you would like it, the way that you're accustomed to it, as in realistic painting. But there is a picture that emerges, and in fact, in the way that he's presenting it, there are some features that become maybe more pronounced than a photograph would be. It has a way of making you see it in a different way. And as I'm gaining a bit of appreciation for this, it's becoming more and more, I don't know, more and more difficult, but I'm seeing that it's very difficult to put together a chronological timeline for the things that we're being presented with. That's not Isaiah's purpose. He wants to impress upon us an overall picture, and the details are in there, but the details are not, he's not trying to lay out a chronological timeline. As a result, in the stuff that we've just read, I'm not sure that what we've read is in chronological order. I don't know. I don't know whether the return of the people from Israel is before the establishment of the throne of David with the descendant of Jesse, or whether it's the other way around, or it's all the same time. I don't think really the passage tells us those kinds of things. So as I think about this, I become very sympathetic and compassionate towards the dilemma faced by Bible scholars at the time of Jesus, who, having read the Old Testament, had come up with this understanding of who the Messiah was and what he would look like. And if you think about this, the first part of 11 and then back in chapter 9, it's talking about this descendant of David that's going to come and he's going to rule. Well, we all know what that would look like, in a sense. And it didn't look like Jesus. So you can understand the confusion when Jesus came. He didn't match what seemed to be prophesied about him. So I can understand the confusion and dilemma that they were in. Jesus fit what was prophesied. And I think similarly, we should keep this in mind when we're thinking about future events that have been prophesied. I think that it is a fairly good bet that when events actually unfold, they won't look quite like we think they're going to look. That whatever picture we put together, it won't be quite like what's coming up. And that it's only when the things come up that we'll be able to say, that's what it was talking about. Much like when people looked out at Jesus, someone who was sensitive to the Spirit of God would be able to say, that's not what I expected, but there's a way in which that fits. That's what it was talking about. So as much as all of us would like to have a clear crystal ball, I don't think that's what we're provided. I think what we're provided with is a murky crystal ball. The outline is there. The essential elements are there. But ultimately, I think we're only going to be able to identify them when they happen. And then the pieces will kind of fit together. That's what it was talking about. Questions or comments?
Dave, in the 11th chapter here, several times it's mentioned the stem of Jesse and then the ensign a couple different places for these different events. Is that three different leaders, one leader that's talking about three times? Are those ensigns and the stem of Jesse all the same person all the way through there?
Well, the ensign or the signal, my Bible translates that signal. He will stand as a signal for the peoples. I think that it really makes the most sense that the first half of 11, 1 through 10, is all talking about both the social order and the natural order under the reign of this one person. That is the descendant of Jesse, this one from the stem of Jesse. So I think as in the flow of that context, I think, yes, it is. It's one ruler. Did I answer your question? The rest of 11, and where do you see in the rest of the, where he will lift up a standard for the nations in 12? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
Yes. I would assume, yes, that that's the same. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would assume that that's the same standard, in a sense. And the wording in 11 is that he will be a standard. In 10, it was he will be a standard. In 12, it's that he will lift up a standard. But I think it's the same image, in a sense, that he himself will be a call for the people of Israel to return, to come back.
Right before you said the last thing, that it isn't necessarily in order. Mm-hmm. While you were talking, I was trying to figure out the order here, and I was going to raise my hand and say, okay, this, and this happened. Mm-hmm. And because it is confusing. Why?
Yes.
Why is it so confusing? Why? It doesn't seem like just this is confusing, but a lot of the scripture,
yes,
seems to be very confusing.
Yes.
Recently, I've been... let me give some background for my question. Recently, I've been listening to a lot of tapes from other churches, in particular the Faith Center here in Eugene, and our emphasis is in such different places. I think we each get part of what's true, partly because of our background or our experience, partly because of the way we study or don't, but nonetheless, even it just becomes very unclear. And we end up at war with each other because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
So your question is, why isn't Scripture clearer, essentially?
Yeah, and it seems like it creates problems,
mm-hmm,
because it's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion, what I have been thinking is, well, then we better give each other a whole lot of latitude. Because we don't know for sure what's going on.
Well, I think that's certainly true, that we need to give each other a lot of latitude. I've been thinking about that question. I used to think that you could sit down and study a passage, and over a period of time, you could come to, within one study period, that is over, I don't know, whatever it takes, weeks or months, you could figure out what a passage says. I am less confident now that that's the case, because it's not that kind of writing. That God has so constructed the Bible that it only opens itself up to those that really want to hear it. That is, you have to want to know, you have to want to listen. And And so in a sense, it requires someone who really wants to hear. I frequently find that I study a passage and then I go away and there are things that keep coming back to me that I mull over as I go through my life and experiences. And as I live more life, things that I studied a long time ago take on a whole different cast. They're still saying the same thing in a sense, but in another sense, they're very different. And it's the same passage. And I think God has created the Bible in such a way that it is material for a lifetime of learning. And that it opens itself up to those who really want to know. And it kind of screens out those who don't really care. And it takes persistence over a long time for it to drive its points home. So I think it's really part of God's strategy that it is difficult and obscure because he wants it to be work. But if we value what's there, it's worth the effort. But we always have to approach it with humility because it is difficult enough that I don't think anyone can say, I have mastered the text and all of its details. We can, I think, master the overriding themes of the Bible. I think that's, well, master them. We can come to know them with confidence and know them quite thoroughly, the main themes. But all in all, we have to maintain an attitude of humility, I think.
Toward the Bible and also toward each other.
Sure.
Because what you might understand from your experience and learning when you're 25 might not be obvious to me till I'm 60. But what I get really easily at 25, you might not get till you're 60. And
certainly,
I think we end up hurting each other and saying, oh, that ridiculous person, they don't get it. When they might get more than us in another area.
Right. That's certainly true. And another aspect of this is that living life is not a set curriculum where you learn step one, then you learn step two, and then you learn step three. We're all on our own customized curriculum. And we don't all learn the same things in the same order. And many of those things are learned through experience of life. That it's a combination of teaching that we receive or study that we do and our course of life that God takes us through. Both of those are powerful influences on how much we understand and know. And we're all in a different curriculum, such that someone else is majoring in something right now that I haven't gotten to yet. And I'm not even ready for yet, and vice versa. I think that's why there's real benefit to seeing, understanding who God is as a communal project. Because there's a sense in which the customized curriculum that God has someone else on has prepared them to teach me things that I have not yet learned, and vice versa. So there's real benefit to coming to understand and discussing these things cooperatively, because we can benefit from the course of study that God has put each person on.
Thank you. I appreciate your perspective a lot.
Thanks. I think the way to think about this best, I think, is to remember my illustration of the coat check woman. We are all coat check women. We've all got some kind of social power, whether it's money or whether it's some kind of position or influence or whatever. So we've all got power that we can use. And the question is, who around me, who is it that God brings across my path that could benefit from the power that I can, that I have? In other words, how can I use the resources and the position that I have to benefit those that God brings my way who are in need of that, of that kind of help? Now, this all becomes very complicated, because we really have to sort out, first of all, who is in need, but secondly, and just as importantly, is what is the nature of the need? And if we truly value what God values, we have to take that second question very seriously. Because let's say someone comes to me and someone crosses my path who is genuinely poor. There's no difficulty establishing that they're poor. And I have money. Now, just giving them money is not necessarily the best thing to do. In fact, it's not necessarily the loving thing to do. That love dictates doing what is in their best interest. And money may not be in their best interest. So, we are in the difficult situation of having to analyze what, in fact, is the nature of the problem. And that takes a great deal of discernment. But we have to have that kind of discernment in order to act effectively and to act lovingly. So, I don't think that there is a set answer to your question, other than to say, we need to be sensitive to the needs of people around us and use the God-given resources that we have to respond in love to those needs, remembering that first we have to determine what exactly is the need.
Yeah, I had a question too. In reading 11, it gets a little bit confusing to me, kind of going on the confusing theme, because it doesn't sound like the ruler is Jesus, because it talks about the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him rather than, well, isn't he the Lord anyway? And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and so on and so forth. Can you kind of address that a little bit?
Well, I would assume that this is similar to what we have when Jesus was baptized and the Spirit came down in the form of the dove. That here it's talking about this person as a human being, but the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. So in other words, he will have a special relationship with God. There are other places in the Old Testament where it talks about the Spirit of the Lord resting upon someone, and usually it's in the context of one of the prophets, like Elijah. So it seems to indicate a special kind of relationship that God is establishing with this person. And I think that's what we have here, that Jesus Christ, as a human being, as a descendant of Jesse, will reign, and he will have the Spirit of the Lord. That is, he will have a special relationship with God that God has established with that human being, Jesus Christ. Okay, thanks.